I hope you all had a happy Thanksgiving, and you're looking forward to happy holidays. The thing we're going to talk about today is happiness, because it's all around us. I teach a course on Western Civ, and when I cover Greek philosophy, I do it from the standpoint of happiness. And I thought it would be worthwhile for us as a body of believers to understand a broader historical context of happiness, so that as you're talking with people, you can move them towards a correct view of happiness and they're able to live happily ever after. One of the difficulties in talking about happiness is defining it. Like, what is this thing called happiness? If you ask most people, are they happy? Most people would probably say, eh. Yeah, under the circumstances, to which you can say, what are you doing under there? Because yeah. circumstances very much affect our sense of happiness. And it's rare to find someone who is perpetually happy. I searched through history for folks who, among other things, are able to rule over Christians, Muslims, and Jews, and highlight them that there are such times in history where you've had this time where people lived happily under the rule of various people. One of my favorites that you guys know about is Suleiman the Magnificent. A little less happy time was under Saladin. Ancient, relatively modern Turkish history, you have a guy called Ataturk. And there's another guy that showed up around 900 or so AD. In Spain, his name was Abd Er Rahman III. I think he might have been the guy who invented the ramen noodles, but I'm not really sure. And
that was his
great-grandpa. Oh, his great-grandpa, all right, because that's how he got the position. He's caliph, which is almost like ruler of Islam at the particular time in history, although he's centered in Spain. And he kind of started a little fragmented kingdom and kind of built it into this empire that was almost worldwide. And he said, I have reigned now about 50 years in victory or peace. I'm beloved by my subjects, dreaded by my enemies, and respected by my allies. Riches, honors, power, and pleasure have waited on my call. And just think about it. Anything you've heard about the richness of an Ottoman ruler, this guy had it like that. Nor does any earthly blessing appear to have been wanting to my felicity. In other words, I haven't had anything I've lacked to be happy. In this situation, I have diligently numbered the days of pure and generous, genuine happiness that have fallen to my lot. Kind of amazing that the guy is there thinking, okay, was this a good day or a bad day? Is it, you know, better than average? Was this a really pure and happy day? So, you know, the guy paid attention to his life. He lived it purposefully. And he said, they have amounted to 14. With everything at his beck and call, anything he wanted, victory and everything else, he got 14 days of happiness. That's like 2 weeks. I guess they didn't have much vacation back in those days. But I'm thinking there's something wrong, because people think that happiness is something you'd always have if you just have this thing, have enough, you'd get it. So a question I ask my class, I'm not going to cover all these things, but I'm going to skim through the things that are applicable to us, is what do you need to be happy? So if you're happy or not happy, what do you need to make yourself happy? If I just had this, I would be happy. And it's funny, as I've observed people over the years and in my own life, I've realized, yeah, I got this, and not only was it not what made me happy, it actually causes me more grief than I thought. So if I just had this computer, I would be happy. And then when that computer goes on the fritz, ah, rotten computer. So what if I just had that person? And then that becomes the bane of your existence. If I just had that job, and then that's your biggest curse. So like, is happiness really dependent on these external things? And the answer is probably going to be no, because people who have that usually aren't happy after they get it. Can you be happy without those things? I mean, were the Beatles right? All you need is love? And then, you know, it starts out well, but, well, you could also use a roof and some food. And, you know, there's other things that eventually, because just all you need is love doesn't seem to actually pan out with many, many years of happily ever after. So if you had all your basic needs met, would you be happy? someone whose basic needs are not met would say, yes. You, whose basic needs are met, would have to say, no, not quite. There's still something missing. And is happiness found in the accumulation of stuff, achievements, success? And people who have that, like our ramen guy, basically would say, no, it's not there either. One of my favorite guys I like to talk about is Alexander, who basically is one of the guys who conquered the world by the time he was your age, for the most part. And what happened at the end? He basically wasn't happy and wound up drinking and, you know, basically trying to escape the pain of, I've gotten it all, and is this all there is? Caesar Augustus, the same thing. 19 years old, conquers, basically rescues civilization, restores the Roman Empire, lives 70 long years, and like Ramen, he reflects back on it. And you can see in his the decrees of the divine Augustus that are posted in the Roman Forum, he wasn't happy. I mean, his big deal was, they closed the streets in my honor. But, you know, that really wasn't what made me happy either. So, if you had all the things that you think you needed to make yourself happy, put yourself there. Would you be happy? And the answer is going to be no, because look back in your life. When you've gotten what you thought would make you happy, it no longer makes you happy. It just diminishes. So what do you do about this? Well, we need to better understand happiness, and the second point on your outline is an attempt to do that. My best take on happiness, it's a sense. And a sense is different from a feeling. A feeling is something that's very transitory. A sense implies an evaluation of how things are going. And the sense that you want is of well-being. There's a song, hymn we sing called, It Is Well With My Soul. And most of you know the history of that, where the guy's family drowned across the Atlantic, and he goes back to the spot where he lost all that he loved. And the captain wakes him up and says, here we are. And in the middle of the night, he goes out and looks at the sea where his family went down. And he pens the words, it is well with my soul. And that's kind of the happiness that you want, that it's well with my soul regardless of the circumstances. I had an opportunity this week to reflect on this. I was sitting in one of my least favorite places in the whole world. It's called the dentist chair. Now, I don't like dentist chair for numerous reasons. One is I don't fit in them, all right? So my back is long, and they always are very uncomfortable. Number two, I can't sit still, all right? I could never do it in stool. I just can't. It's like a torture for me to have to sit still. And you know that if you don't sit still, this drill that's boring into you could just slip, and then you need a root canal, and we all know what that's like. All right, so I'm sitting there as a dentist takes these, you know, sharp hollow metal tubes and puts them into my tooth on one side. Then he goes on the inside, and if you ever had to get the injection on the inside, you know how that feels. It's like really bad. But it's good because it's numbing you, almost. You can still feel some things, and you feel the vibration, you hear the noise, you smell the bone getting chewed up. It's like a gruesome... All right. So I'm there trying to get my mind off this, and I start thinking about the couple things I have to do after my dentist appointment. Trust me, they were more emotionally traumatic than the dentist experience. And so, you know, and the worst thing about the dentist experience is that you actually, at the end, have to thank him for hurting you, and then you pay for the privilege of the pain, you know. So then I started thinking about, well, my sermon, and I was wrestling with happiness for the week, and then it dawned on me, wow, I'm actually happy. How can I be happy with all these horrible things going on? Well, it's because I got this sense of, yeah, it is well with my soul. At the current moment, things couldn't get much better. You know, being out of the chair and everything, you know, that would be fun, better. But at the moment, things were about as good as they were going to get. I had a filling that kind of broke and some infection got underneath it, and I didn't lose my tooth. And I was happy for that. And then I wasn't going to have a root canal. I was happy for that. And I had the means to be able to get the treatment. In another day and age, I wouldn't have had it. And it was going to get better. And I know it's going to be pain for a couple days, but then it was good. It was going to be fixed, and then I wouldn't have to think about it again. And I got this sense of, yeah, it's okay, it's good. I might not like the current circumstances, but I sense that things are going to get better as a result of this, and I had a feeling of happiness. not the happiness that some people get when they go to the Village of Happiness for the outlets and shop. You know, that we call more ecstasy and bliss, but it was this general sense that things were good, and that's kind of what you want to shoot for in terms of happiness, that at the moment they couldn't get much better. Now, is that something that you can have all the time? And I think you can get it as a pretty constant companion. Some of you might know there's this thing called the Bluebird of Happiness. It's, you know, from some songs and musicals and myths and things like that. But it's not this thing that just suddenly alights on you and then it's gone. It's actually, it can be your constant companion. I want to talk about how to have that happen today. Happiness is diminished by things like anxiety, anger, bitterness, unforgiveness, and I didn't put guilt there, but there's two kinds of things. When you fail to forgive others, you get bitter and angry. And you fail to feel forgiven, you feel guilt, and someone's going to find you out, and there's some fear there. Despair, if you don't have hope, you know, if you think, if I thought life is going to be forever in a dentist chair, I would probably not ever have the Bluebird of Happiness visit me. It would be miserable. But there was hope that it was going to be over and it would get better. When you're discontent, and I've done a couple outlines on contentment, because I need to have something else. I don't like what I got. I want something different. I don't see any way I'm going to get it. And you get anxious and unhappy. Dissatisfaction with what you have. Loneliness. I think I might have misspelled that. I don't know. Maybe I spelled it right. So those things diminish happiness, which tells you happiness isn't this static quality. It's very fragile. Happiness can be enhanced by joy. And one of my outlines has a point that joy comes from choosing what's best. That's a choice. Happiness, I don't think necessarily is a choice, but it's a reflection on the choices that you've made. Happiness is enhanced by peace. It's well with my soul. Being content. You know, God's good. He'll give me what's best. What I've got is what's best. There's nothing I can do to make it better right now, so I can just be content with the way things are. It's enhanced by positive relationships. I had to go back and put the positive mark there because one of the things that diminishes our happiness more than anything else is bad relationships. When a desire is fulfilled, you're happy. You've worked at a goal. You've struggled. You've strained. You've experienced pain and you hit your goal. That feels good. But then, how long does that last? Getting the basics of pleasure. Pleasure is different from happiness because pleasure is more transitory and more oriented to the senses. Happiness is a thing that's more of a way we frame things in our mind. Having possessions can definitely add to your happiness, particularly if it's an iPhone of the latest model. Having power, you know, security and significance, those are two elements and components of power. Those, you know, you get those. If you don't have those, it's like happiness is going to be diminished. You have those, that's really good stuff to have. Success, and then of course, let's not leave out love and affection. Raman had a lot of these things, and it just was only a temporary thing. So how do you get it more enduring? Well, enduring happiness is developed. It's a skill. It's developed by training and by disciplining your mind and emotions. You want to discipline your mind and emotions. The Dalai Lama has published a book called The Secret of Happiness. And in it, he talks about happiness being a discipline of mind. And I have to agree with him. I might disagree with him on some stuff, but I would agree with him on this, that it really is a mental process that has to be developed as you discipline your thinking and your emotions. Otherwise, things will come in, like a dentist drill, and you're going to say, oh, bad. But then you realize, no, good. Because of what it's going to get me. And you kind of have to think beyond the immediate sense to the outcome. That's a mental process, and you have to train your mind to do that. Happiness is transitory if it's relative. Like, oh, it could be worse. You know, I'm doing better than others. Well, what happens when it does get worse? You know, now it's no longer happiness. Or what happens when someone does better than you? It's like, oh, man, I didn't know that. You know, I should have had that. So it's if you just make your happiness on relative circumstances, you won't have it enduring. Similarly, circumstantial or emotionally based happiness no longer endures. I want you guys to help develop a sense of happiness that is enduring and is kind of part of the abundant life that Christ came to give. As most of you know, this is an outline from my class, and I developed it a speck different because of the way the textbook was progressing. Truth is that which best explains all the facts. And you know it's at the convergence of revelation, reason, and reality. In my course, we had not gotten to the revelation part yet, so that's why it's out of line. The reality piece is the senses. This is what you can sense. You can taste, you can touch, you can feel, you can actually see it, experience in real life. And the Sophist, a philosophical group of 300-400 BC, and Aristotle were the premier examples of this kind of thinking, that you want to find truth based on what you can sense. Other people in that time frame is that, no, it's, senses are suspect. And this is where Socrates and Plato came in. And they said, no, your perceptions are faulty. You can't really be sure of what you're seeing. You perceive things differently. You process it incorrectly. Reason and reason alone is the means of discovering truth. And then eventually, as the religious pieces come in, you have them say, well, no, it's revelation. It's like the gods tell us what we need to know. Well, my view is, truth is that which best explains all the facts, and it should be found at the convergence of all three of these things, revelation, reason, and reality. And when you have a piece that matches, a divinely authenticated revelation, matches what your senses see, matches what reason reasons out for you, logically consistent, then you can say, yeah, we got it. This is truth, or at least our best contender for truth, and we're not going to find anything better, but we'll keep looking if necessary. So, Greek philosophy rejected myth, the whole pantheon of gods. The serious thinkers didn't believe them. They believed they were gods, but not the ones represented by the cartoon figures. They believed in an ultimate reality which was responsible for the unity and order of the universe, and they sought to seek that, or they sought to discover that. So we're going to look for the truth about happiness. We're going to look at what these guys had to say about it. We're going to look at what revelation has to say about it, and then we're going to look at how what reality says about it. So we're going to go reason, then revelation, and then the reality piece. What's happiness and how do you get it would be a subtext for this. So number four, Sumerians, I want to cover these guys, but I did want to mention that the Epic of Gilgamesh is considered the oldest piece of literature that's extant. And it's a story of a half-god man that kind of goes and tries to figure out what's worth living in life. And it's kind of cartoonish, but it reflects the search of man for happiness, and it's a despairingly difficult story. He doesn't find it. It's despairing. And the Sumerians were the first civilization that we have decent records of. And their literature is marked by uncertainty, anxiety, depression. It's like no happiness is going to be found there. Which is kind of surprising that there's nothing of happiness in the literature that we found there. Egyptians got a little better, the Persians got a little better, but the piece I want to mention, because you see these people all around today, are the Sophists. They were like the wisdom people. They were in contradistinction to guys like Plato, Aristotle, and I guess Socrates before them. They were relativist. Everything was relative. There were no absolutes. And you just want to accumulate stuff more than others, and that'll make you happy. Get power, get pleasure, get possessions by any means, by hook or by crook, and then you'll be happy. And what that basically does is removes the rational component of man and turns him into an animal. Like, what difference is that between might makes right and these guys? None. Just like an animal, if you can go eat other animals, you're going to be happy. And if you get eaten, that's tough luck, and that's the way life is. And there are people in our culture that basically think, oh, if I just got more than someone else, and I don't really care who I hurt, how I get it, if I lie, cheat, steal, whatever way I get the most stuff, I'll feel good. And in the process, they lose their humanity, and they've turned into an animal. And they'll meet the fate of animals, and they wind up not being happy. There's no long-term enduring happiness, just a temporary thrill of these kind of folks. And they're around today. You probably identify them as your coworkers, particularly your boss. the higher up the food chain you go in business, these people, in one sense, exist. There's another category we'll talk down below of the Stoics that also you'll find in upper echelons of management. Things got a little better in terms of the philosophical scene when we get to my friend Socrates. He's kind of the father of more rational thought. Okay, there's lots of other people before him. No one knows who the exact father was because we don't have all the literature from that day and age. It's gone. But his work survived through Plato and then extended in Aristotle. So he's a good guy to understand. His view was after observing life, I guess they had a lot of time back then because they couldn't surf the internet, so they had to observe life and conclude what's this underlying reality to life. And I think I would agree with him that senses are suspect. They're not always faulty, but you need to verify them based on reason and revelation. He said there are universal values. They're discovered by reason. They shape your character. And you shape your character to achieve moral excellence, ethical excellence. You do what's good rather than that's bad. That's the purpose of life. And this is the pinnacle of Greek philosophy, that you strive for moral excellence. The word that some of you are familiar with is called arete. It's the name of the debate club that we've got. And it's you strive for excellence ethically as well as performance-wise. Ethics is what's good or bad. You know, his disciple Plato said, evil's a lack of knowledge. If we find what's good, we'll do it. So all you have to do is tell people what's good, and voila, it happens. They do what's good, they achieve moral excellence, they're happy. Well, that works if you are a Greek who is well-schooled, well-disciplined in other things, that you can seek the good, and when you find it, do it. If just knowledge was responsible for goodness, then universities would be the, you know, epitome of integrity and honesty. And, you know, you just, normally whenever I do this in my class, I can find someone that's in the faculty who's just been, you know, outed for, you know, extortion or, you know, what's the, embezzlement and other, you know, kind of things like that. So the thinking is a little faulty there. And that's because man is innately and environmentally evil, and we're blind to good. So the other end of the spectrum, looking a little more from, you still guided by reason, you get this guy called Aristotle. And he wrote a book called Nicomachean Ethics, a whole book that really deals with the subject of happiness. And I've excerpted a couple pieces from my students' readings on here. And what he said is something that's worth reflecting on. You won't get this the first time you read it, but it will be on the exam. Oh, wait, wrong section. Happiness is an activity of your mind, your will, and your emotions. That was the Greek word for soul. It's activity that you do with your mind, your will, and common emotions that's in accord with perfect virtue. And virtue is having your passions governed by noble objectives. So happiness is this activity, it's this process of using who you are to get the noble objectives, and you channel all your activities towards a good objective. And this concept of happiness shows up in the New Testament, which is why it's applicable for us talking about it in church. Aristotle basically viewed the noble objective to be determined by the golden mean. And for example, he said that in terms of courage, it's kind of midway between being a coward and being rash. So it's somewhere in the middle. And liberality was a virtue, but how do you know how much you should be giving? Well, it's somewhere between being wasteful and being too frugal and hoarding. Pride was somewhere between being vain and humble. And in the Greek philosophical tradition, humility was a bad thing, which is interestingly as that interfaced with Christianity, because it was being less than you were as opposed to all you should be. Temperance was something in the middle between abstinence, being a teetotaler, and then abusing pleasure. So he said, you find the golden mean, and then you take all that you've got to achieve it in your life, and then you will be happy. And I think you would be happier than not. Let's particularly look at temperance. You wouldn't miss out on the pleasure, but you wouldn't have a hangover. So you have enough wine to make you feel good, but not enough to give you a hangover and throw up. You know, that would be his golden mean. So as long as you didn't throw up in those days, you were good. Really regardless of what you did. Now, a quote that I have for him that I think is interesting, particularly those of you in the debating camps will appreciate this, and those in the libertarian state camp will not appreciate this. He said, the duty of the state is to provide citizens with material goods, such as individual and collective defense and security. So far, so good. Healthcare is not listed there. Also to provide them with the possibility of self-development. Really intriguing. Which would not be otherwise available. You could read public education in there. But here's the reason I put the quote in. Above all, the duty of the state is to direct men to the attainment of happiness through virtue. Moral excellence. That's how you get to happiness. You discipline your mind and your emotions so you can hit the objectives that ultimately make a good difference. As I'm sitting in a dentist chair, it takes me a lot to control my impulse to bolt. You know, I feel like the dog that's been given a bath and just can't wait to get out of the tub. And I'm waiting. And if I basically didn't discipline my mind and feelings and things, I would be out of there. Like, there's no way I would stay there for the pain, because all my instinctual survival skills say, get out of here, this is bad. But my mind has to put a layer over that saying, no, this is good. This is actually the best way to the best of all possible worlds for your life. So like some of the difficulties with Plato, Aristotle had the same problem. People can't do this today. They haven't been trained as they've been growing up to control their emotions. I remember when we lived on the north edge of the village, we had a friend and we went to the playground with it, and the kids at the playground, it was a jungle. And they were saying, these are both New York, duffy parents kind of thing, saying, yeah, we need to encourage his aggressiveness because that's what he needs to survive. Yeah, well, you might survive, but you're not going to be married happily ever after if you've basically been trained all your life to just express your aggressiveness. I mean, like, you're raising monsters. You know, it's like they can only be controlled by the sword. Welcome to our world. All right, so you need training and self-control to act according to knowledge and choose what's best. And in some cases, there isn't a golden mean. All right, so we don't have too many of Aristotle's ilk in our day, looking for the golden mean. But we do have a lot of followers of Epicurus. He's the guy who invented this thing called hedonism. And we all know what that is, Hugh Hefner and company. But it's not the Hugh Hefner and company pleasure. Epicurus believed that the sole good in life was pleasure. In contrast, Aristotle believed the sole good in life was happiness. And he makes an interesting case for it, a little sidebar here. He said, you want money, but what do you want it for? You want fame, you want status, you want prestige, but what do you want it for? You want it to be happy. But what do you want happiness for? You want it as an end in itself. So he could not think of what you want happiness for beyond anything else, so therefore he said the chief purpose of life is happiness. The Dalai Lama also would kind of agree with him. I'm not sure if he read him or if he came to this from his reasonings, that the chief good of man is happiness. Even in traditional Protestantism, you know, what's the chief end of man? It's to glorify God and enjoy him forever. And yeah, it's true. It's to be blessed by God in the Judeo-Christian sense. And it's a pretty good end. But the means by which he attained pleasure was inadequate. And there's virtue is sometimes... you have to sacrifice pleasure to get virtue. And that's something that Epicurus didn't like. He said that pleasure was not sensual gratification, because you get diseases and hangovers from that, but it's freedom from pain and worry. It's freedom from reason. Reason gives you a headache. So you need to just get off that. And his idea was you would withdraw from society with a group of friends. He's a first hippie. And I'm not sure if they grew pot back then, but you know, if he was in our day and age, he would be in Washington State growing pot, withdrawing from society, thinking, I'm happy. But there's multiple problems with this. Because if you withdrew from the service of the state, you no longer could protect yourselves against invading hordes, and your manner of life was not sustainable. It missed on the reality piece. If everybody did that, who would protect you from the barbarians? And thus it fails as a philosophy of life. It also can't explain sacrifice. There are people who sacrifice themselves for a higher objective. The mother sacrificing herself for her child. The knight in the blue serge suit basically sacrificing himself to go and do his job that he hates to be able to provide for his family. You know, those noble things aren't explained for in this philosophy of life. But your friends and coworkers, and probably even yourself in some things, think, oh, if I can just get to a spot where I eliminate all the things that cause me discomfort, then I'll be happy. So you get rid of your wife, your kids, you know, your job and all, and then, are you going to be happy? And they're basically, if you're caught up in the pursuit, you never realize the end goal is no. And if you're pursuing the accumulation of stuff, you think, if I just get that, will I be happy? Same error. You're caught up in the pursuit, and you fail to realize that the end goal is no. The other end of the spectrum, these are guys who came after Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, was Zeno. And they met in a patio called the Stoa, which is where we get Stoicism from. So it's like the patio people. And you get little Japanese lanterns around it and drinks. No. You know, these guys believed that the highest good was virtue. So far, so good. We're doing well. Okay, we're back in the rational vein. You want to live and you want to reason and you want to will in harmony with the divine will. So basically, you're training your soul to live in harmony with the divine will, which they called nature. Vice was desire. Vice was emotion. Vice was stuff that's contrary to reason. So our idea of a Stoic is someone who's like unmoved by anything around them. They sit there and float above the ground 2 inches off in the lotus position, and they're immovable. Well, they've kind of cut off half their humanity because they haven't learned how to deal with the passionate side of things. And they're not fully human in that regard. Their concept of happiness was submission or acceptance of the divine will. Gives you peace, and you get on with life. And you'll actually find a lot of people in higher management who've kind of developed a Stoic approach. They're not so good at the interpersonal relations, but they are calm enough to guide organizations through shareholder meetings. But they don't work well in families or communities and stuff like that because they're missing the emotional part. They're good in terms of serving the divine spark in all mankind. They've got a fatalistic predestination view. They don't, you know, there's some problems with them. We don't need to go into that. Okay, so that's the reason part. I want to look at the revelation part. The Old Testament, a thing that basically starts Western Civ, says, you control your happiness. It's not this fatalistic determinism. You have a choice. You can choose to go one way and get these consequences, or you can choose to go another way and get a different set of consequences. Your choice. What do you want? Celebrates the free will, the full humanity of a human being. God reveals himself as the God who loves to bless, like right in chapter 1 of the Old Testament. He says, you know, his first activity after creation is to bless man. And if we actively seek what God wants, and then we please him, we'll get to a place of blessing. It's a major theme in the Old Testament. You see it highlighted most, you know, right in the front with Genesis chapter 12 when Abraham gets called by God and God says, hey, Abe. Abe goes, who's that? And he says, I want you to go to a place I'm going to show you and I'm going to bless you. And here's how I'm going to bless you. I'm going to make you great. I'm going to give you kids. All the world's going to be blessed through you. So clearly God is a God of blessing, but to get the blessings, you have to do what he says. That theme gets repeated again and again and again in the Old Testament, and people keep missing it. Psalm 1 starts out with, blessed is the man who doesn't do what God doesn't like, but does what God likes. And for him, life is going to be good. And in some of your versions, you'll actually find the word Hebrew word for blessed translated happy. And that's a good translation of it. The Hebrew underneath it basically would mean a little bit more, the guy who's to be envied. Like, I want to be like that. The one who is blessed is the one who is envied, is the one who is happy. The commands are given for our good. Psalm 23, you all know this one, they say it at most gravesides, but it also is a good one for daily life, even when you're not dead. You say, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. It is well with my soul. I have a sense of well-being. World's wisest guy, later on in the poetic literature of Scripture, said Solomon in the book of Ecclesiastes, who had more power, more pleasure, more possessions than anybody before him or after him, puts the Roman guy to shame. He said, you know, the only way you're going to be able to enjoy life is if you always please God, because it's a gift from God he gives to those who please him. And anything else is vanity. It's meaningless. It's chasing after the wind. It's a mist that just is gone. And you woke up this morning. I know where I was, there was a lot of fog, and now the sun comes out, it's gone. And most of the things we go after in the fog, we think, oh yeah, if I just had that, and then we get it, or it's gone. And Solomon said, basically, pick your consequences. Serve God, don't do evil, and he will bless you, and you'll get it. The New Testament, which follows the Old Testament, basically unpacks the same ideas. There's hardly anything new. Very, very little new in the New Testament that was not in the Old Testament. And Christianity says it a little more explicitly, you need to shift your values in accord with the truth and love. You need to do what's in another's best interest, love one another, that kind of thing. And then you get blessed. Jesus' very first sermon in the beginning of Matthew, in the Sermon on the Mount, opens up with, happy is the man. You have eight Beatitudes. Beatitudes means blessed. And it's the same idea of the Hebrew Old Testament, Psalm 1. This is how you get blessed. And if you look at that, the one that's really intriguing in there, like, you know, blessed are the peacemakers, they'll be told children of God. But the one that always causes me to kind of sit up and take notice is, blessed are you when men revile you and persecute you and say all manner of evil against you falsely. Oh, that's like going to the dentist. Why should I be happy if that happens? Now the mind comes in. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad. Commands. You need to control your emotions. Why? Then the reason is given. Your reward in heaven is great. So there's some more objective reality out there that controls my subjective experience, which causes me to have a sense of well-being. And you see this work out in the lives of the early apostles, like, you know, Peter and Paul when they got beaten by the high priest for talking about Jesus, or Paul when he gets thrown into the Philippian jail with Barnabas singing praises. It's a consistent kind of theme that goes through. Big theme in Philippians, most of you know this, joy results from choosing what's best. And the Old Testament wisdom says that what's best is picking the objectives that will get you where you want to be at the end. It's the right objective, the right means of obtaining objectives. That's Greek virtue as well, their purpose of life. And the neat thing about it is even suffering can be meritorious, as we just saw. Those of you who know 1 Peter and James understand those verses right there. You can go look them up on your own if you don't know them. Say something to that effect. And then a thing that's really good in Christianity is passion is good. Actually, even in the Old Testament, passion is good if channeled correctly. Passion is bad if used incorrectly. It's a fire. And I'm not just talking about sexual passion, but all passion and desire needs to be channeled. It just can't be let run like Epicurus would. It needs to be put and focused. I also teach a couple lectures on Islam in my course. And it's amazing the stuff you can find when you read. But this quote in Islam, most people aren't aware of, and I think it's cool. As a general principle in Islam, there's some Stoic philosophy, some Zoroastrianism that had flowed into Muhammad's thinking, or revelation, if you will. And you can actually go see some of the sources that he got that were written before him. It says the same thing he said. Well, people have trouble with that, but that's the case. Submission to the will of Allah, which is their view of the word of God, and submission to his prophet Muhammad, very convenient, is what causes you happiness. That will bring you pleasure. But so that's their basic principle. Submit gives you pleasure. Nothing else matters. All you need to do is submit. No mind, no emotions, just use your will, submit. Do what we say, and even if it's miserable, eventually it'll give you pleasure. So in one sense, they cut out all of this life to live for another life, which looks very, very suspect. So I think it has a little failing in there. But there's a really interesting passage. It's in the fifth book, Surah. It's in, like, their books are in sequential order, going from largest to smallest. So the fifth book, the 69th verse, says, in reference to Jews and Christians, Muhammad reveals this as coming from Allah in the infinite Quran. If only they had stood fast, which means follows, the law, the gospel, and all the revelation that was sent to them from their Lord, they would have enjoyed happiness on every side. So the Quran allows for the first five books of the Old Testament, the Psalms of David, the Gospels, the Evangelists, what they call them. And he said, if they just followed it, they would have found happiness on every side. And I think in Christendom, there are lots of unhappy people because they're just not following what God said. If he created life, he knows what's going to make us happy. So, like, why not try what he said? Better yet, commit yourself to doing it, and eventually you would find happiness on every side. And he makes the acknowledgement, there is from among the Jews and Christians a party on the right course. So in his day and age, 600 or so AD, there were people who were following and were getting happiness. But many of them follow a course that is evil, which is true even today. The Muslim view of happiness is that was directed to the Jews and Christians and everything. In the 30th book, which doesn't necessarily follow 25 down the road, it's just that much shorter. Then those who have believed and worked righteous deeds shall be made happy in the meat of delight. So he's talking about Muslims who are believing and doing what they're supposed to do, which is submitting to Allah, would be made happy. Okay, last one. That's the revelation piece. So the reason piece should be you've got to train your mind to live objectively so you can properly frame the difficult things that come into your life and realize that it can be well with your soul. The revelation piece says something very similar. God has revealed stuff that we should do that is in our best interest, which if we follow will result in happiness, and which if we don't follow will result in unhappiness, either as natural consequences or interventions by God in blessing or cursing. So, sounds good in theory, would it work in practicality? So one of my favorite guys on this subject is David Myers. He writes the most commonly used college psychology textbook. And he's also written a book called The Pursuit of Happiness, in which he examined hundreds of studies, doctoral dissertations, on the subject of happiness, and came up with a whole bunch of things that are myths about happiness, and then boiled down into about 8 points, or 9, 10, whatever, things that do enable happiness. And whenever you find happy people, you find these things. This is the reality piece. Studies, surveys, observations, questionnaires, all the things, this is what it comes down to. And you're going to find out it's consistent with what happened up above. And the cool thing is, each of these things is something that you have control over. It's not random. It's a consequence of how you think and how you act. Fit and healthy bodies. How do you get them? You send away for some mail order thing, I think that's how you get them. So that's something people have control over. And if you don't have your health, you tend not to be as happy if you're constantly in pain. You tend to not feel as happy as things aren't good because they could be better. Realistic goals and expectations. That's why I do the Time of Your Life seminar, to help people develop realistic goals and expectations for their life and then achieve them. Positive self-esteem. What gives positive self-esteem? I have some outlines on this, but basically you get worth and value for doing what's right in God's sight. Even if it's suffering for talking about Jesus in the day of the apostolic age. Positive self-esteem comes from performance. The very first verse that shows up for our time on this planet is in Genesis 4, and it says, if you want to be accepted, do what's right. Yeah, that's consistent all the way through the scriptures. Feelings of control. You can basically see it. If you can set a goal, achieve it, and affect your destiny, you feel better about yourself. You're not a victim. You can choose what happens. That gives you optimism. That was another thing. You have a positive view for the future because you know that your actions can change your future, which is why things like Stoicism, Islam in this regard, Epicureanism, basically fail as life philosophies, because you can't affect the future. You can just react to the present if you're an Epicurean. But if you affect your future, you have optimism. Like, I can make life better. If I don't like something, I can change it. That's what God's grace is all about. It gives you power to change things if you don't like them. It gives you power to do His will. And then outgoingness. If life is working well for you, you tend to want to be a little more social. If life is working really bad, you withdraw. Recluses are people who basically don't have life going well for them. Supportive friendships that enable companionship and confiding. You can just see how trying to love other people biblically according to the commands of Scripture would give you these things, because you become other-centered rather than self-centered in your life dealings. Most of us have tried the self-centered route and realized that hasn't worked very well. A socially intimate, sexually warm, equitable marriage. You take out the sex piece, that would also apply to relationships. There's an equitable piece in there. It's give and take. It's mutual pleasuring. That can happen in all kinds of relationships. Pleasure on more level than just the sexual. Challenging work and active leisure punctuated by adequate rest and retreat. It is possible to experience happiness and be in the center of the will of God, being under a whip, building an Egyptian pyramid. It's not the thing you'd normally choose, but if you're stuck in there, you could do it. And I do this in my sermon on contentment. It's possible to be happy and have a sense of it's well with my soul if your job is to clean up the vomitorium as a Roman slave who happened to become a Christian during the reign of the empire. You know, even if those situations are bad, but we would tend to like more challenging work. But all of us have things about our jobs we don't like. And learning to deal with those is mental discipline. Learning to control our emotions, learning to understand the values that we have, that we bring to the workplace, and realize that it's working to a better good, which is me being able to control how I think and how I feel. That's kind of good. Then you can use that in challenging work, active leisure, adequate rest and relaxation. And then this shows up in every study. It's amazing. All the secular studies will actually note this. You need a faith, a belief in revelation that entails communal support, it's a body, purpose for living. Yeah, if you don't have that, you're kind of a goner. Acceptance by others, outward focus, and hope. Those are the things that enable happiness. This is the definitive study on it. If you want to find anything else, like if you have my notes on this, you'll see there's a Gallup poll and some other things. They basically get joined into this, and these are some of the principles that I try to work into people's lives in the 12th seminar. So you have in front of you all it takes to be happy. I can take a couple questions. We started late, so yeah, John.
If I could just summarize what you said with respect to purpose, means, result, and reason. So the purpose, that is, please God, glorify God. Means is really through obedience and developing virtue, which is enabled by channeling our passions, disciplining our minds, and obtaining the grace that God gives. The reason is that there's different consequences, either cursing or blessing, whether it's a testament or a testament, and positive or negative reward, so there's different consequences. And the result is what you just alluded to, which is happiness, a state of well-being, whether it's here or hereafter. Is that
right, I'd qualify the first one by saying that it's pleasing God according to his revelation. And I'd qualify the one before the last one, third one, with there's both short-term consequences and long-term consequences. There's temporal consequences and eternal consequences, and that would be a good summary. Yes, Steve.
So, joy is something that we can always have because it's a choice. I choose, right? I'm choosing what goes or whatever. Happiness, happiness and contentment, and let's just use Job's life. So there's before, during, and after. So before, he's happy, joyful, and content. In the trial, is he all three? I'm guessing he's joyful.
He's questioning. He's confused. I'm not sure if I could actually peg where he is at that. I don't know. He's definitely, if he's mourning in sackcloth and ashes, it's not there. He hasn't really, it doesn't know what. He's in shock. You know, like one thing, he's like, boom, what happened? You know, and so then as the story develops, he builds a conviction that none of what I have has happened to me is warranted by my actions. At that point, I think there would be hope expressed in, I know that my Redeemer lives and I'm going to stand vindicated. Even though he slays me, I'm going to trust him. I will stand vindicated on the earth the last day. So at that point, I think there is this growing sense of well-being. It's not a consequence of what I've done. I just don't know what the picture is. God's allowed this for some reason. At the end, he's back to that normal peace. But this large section in the middle, as he's wrestling through it, I'd have a hard time, just off the top of my head, trying to figure out exactly what he's feeling there. But I do want to highlight the fact that the choice is joy. You can choose joy. I did what's right. It's the best thing I could have done. I'm glad. Or I suffered for righteousness' sake. God's going to make it up to me. Yeah, that's his choice. The happiness piece is a little more of a reflection on it. So I chose it, the best that could happen right now. Okay, there's going to be negative consequences ahead of me, but if God gave me the grace to make the right choice, he'll give me the grace to go through the consequences. So it's more how you frame the choices that you made is what results in the sense of happiness.
Okay, so it's not like I should always be joyful, or I can even strive for always being joyful and happy, but
yeah, because there's, as Solomon said, it is a time for crying, there's a time for tears, there's a time to weep, there's a time to mourn, and we do that with others. So there's, like, we grieve, but not without hope. We have joy when someone that we love dies because we know they're in heaven, but we ourselves are suffering loss. And it takes a while to come to the awareness of, okay, God can make that up to me. So I'm not looking for people, Stepford Wives smiles. because we're real people and we have a full range of emotions. And there's times to be disappointed when you don't get things. Then you reflect on it. So like, oh, all that thing I was working for, the school I wanted to get into, the job I wanted to get, the person I loved, all that was gone. I'm so happy. No, yeah. Yeah, that doesn't happen right away. It's the reflection on it because of the disciplined mind. And the better your mind is, the more you've trained your mind to have the right values, the more quickly you get over the disappointments of life. Yeah.
When I was in New York living in a little garret down in the village, and out of school, stowed way too many wild oats, kind of at sea, my father, who was one of the wisest and smartest and good men I've ever met, came to New York. I don't remember the reason now, maybe just to see me, and we were sitting and talking in our living room. He said to me, "Teton, my nickname, what are you doing? And with your life?" And I said, "I'm looking for happiness." Huh. He said, "And you'll never be happy because you don't find happiness, you make happiness. You create it, you develop it, but you don't find it." That was the turning point in my life, just those few words. He's not a pontificator, but it sort of feeds into what
you're saying. Yeah, it does, very good point.
Here, and it changed my whole outlook on life and when I would have.
And you went out and made your happiness.
So I just thought I would pass that.
Very good point. Thanks.
You said that happiness is a result of whose choices.
Yeah. Yes. Joy comes first from making the good choices. The piece that is the reflection on it. So you can be making good choices, but unless you stop and think, oh, yeah, I'm making the good choice. Because some people automatically make the best choices. They've done the spiritual kung fu and, wah, I make the right choice. But, you know, then... Okay, but then there's the reflection on it that kind of gives the sense of well-being. It's a, you sense it from the choices you've made. Yes?
Technical question. What's the note, on number six, the promise in parentheses? You're giving examples of things that don't have a meaning.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Those are things that don't have means. Like, I don't want my students to fall in love with Aristotle. Not that any of them would anyway. But just from a logical perspective, there's no golden mean on some stuff. For instance, keeping your word. Is there a golden mean of this? Either keeping your word or not keeping your word. There's not some mean of, well, I'll keep half of it, part of it, whatever. Yeah. So his that I use that to start making the case for revelation. Because his philosophy is incapable of explaining all of life. Okay, our food is here, so I am incapable of talking any longer. So let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you that you care about our joy, you care about our happiness. You created us with the capacity for these things, the desire for these things, and a plan to fulfill these things. We praise you for being a God that is good and who blesses. Lord, help us be a people that live in light of your truth and experience the blessings that you have promised. Guide us in having the right thinking, the right feeling, and help us experience the consequences that you've have in store for those who walk with you. We commit ourselves to this task singly and with each other. In Christ's name, amen.